Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Mark Danner, who is in Ramallah in the Palestinian territory, and discuss the upcoming declaration of Palestinian statehood at the United Nations that the Saudis are warning the US not to veto. We will also talk with Mark Danner's about Mark Danner's latest essay in the New York Review of Books, After September the 11th, Our State of Exception. Then, following the President's recent address to Congress to urge the creation of more jobs, we'll talk with Douglas Rushkoff about whether jobs are obsolete in the digital age, where technology is increasing efficiency that results in more people being laid off while increasing corporate profits. Douglas Rushkoff teaches media studies at NYU and is the author of Program or Be Programmed, 10 Commands for a Digital Age, and Life, Inc., How Corporations Conquered the World and How We Can Take It Back. Joining us now is Mark Danner, who is a writer, journalist, and professor. Mark Danner was a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker. He's a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books and teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and Bard College. His books include Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War, The Secret Way of War, The Downing Street Memo, and The Iraq War's Buried History, and Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. He has an article, After September the 11th, Our State of Exception, now at the New York Review of Books. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Danner.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here.
And you are, of course, in Ramallah, on the West Bank, about to be declared a Palestinian state. We've got so much to talk about. Can I begin with that? In as much as in Monday's New York Times, there is an article by the former head of Saudi intelligence, Prince Turki, basically laying down a pretty strong marker to the United States and saying, you know, the U.S.'s credibility is pretty thin in the Arab world. And as far as the Saudis are concerned, if they don't go along with Palestinian statehood, the Saudi relationship with the United States will change forever. And it's a pretty stark warning. Is it likely to be listened to, do you think?
Well, I think if you consider being listened to an actual change in policy in Washington, to do what Prince Turki is urging, which is that the United States refrain from vetoing the resolution for Palestinian statehood, I think it's very unlikely to be observed in Washington. I do think it's an extremely serious shot across the bow of U.S. policy. Prince Turki is a very highly respected member of the Saudi royal family. He was for many years the head of Saudi intelligence. He knows where all the bodies are buried, and then finished his career with holding the ambassadorship in Washington. So he's extremely well connected. And this is a rather fierce piece, essentially saying that U.S. Middle East policy with respect to the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations has been fruitless, stagnant, and without issue, and that the U.S. is about to make a terrible error by setting it back still further by vetoing this resolution for statehood, which will cost it very materially among regimes in the Arab world, including the Saudis. It's rather strikingly angry and aggressive piece. I must say I was rather startled by the tone, and also by the fact that there's a rationale that's quite compelling in it, which is that the Assad regime in Damascus, according to the prince, is about to collapse. The Saudis issued an extremely strong statement condemning Bashar al-Assad for killing civilians. And the prince at this point basically says, look, you Americans are in a great position to weaken your arch rival in the region, the Iranians, by unseating the Assad regime. And just as you're about to do that, you're going to make this huge diplomatic mistake, which is going to cost you a great deal of sympathy on the part of Arab countries, particularly the ones that newly feel the necessity to listen to their populations, like Egypt, in the wake of the Arab Spring. So he makes a pretty compelling argument that this will be a serious diplomatic mistake and perhaps a cataclysmic one. What's so sad is that, you know, on reading it, you think, well, there's absolutely no chance that the Obama administration will not veto this resolution. So I guess it indicates how frozen and stagnant and sclerotic American policy on this issue has been under the Obama administration.
But Mark Denner, I think the implication surely from Prince Turkey is that if the U.S. vetoes this, as it will because of, you know, the power of the Israel lobby in the Congress and on the White House, they have actually more influence over the Democrats than they do over the Republicans. And that seems to be the assumption that's why the president simply has no room to maneuver, which in itself is a discussion, a topic for a long discussion. Seems odd that the United States shouldn't have its own independent foreign policy in this regard. However, what I think he's implying here, Prince Turkey, is that this veto of Palestinian statehood from the Americans may actually change the subject in Syria, which is what the Assad dictatorship is trying to do. They've already played the Palestinian card. They'd love to have this card to play again to distract the world from their brutality towards their own people. And the Iranians are in there supplying, not only are they propping this government up with money, they're also sending in their IRGC thugs and besieged militias and Al-Quds people to crack heads and murder Syrians. So,
yeah. Yes, you're right. It is a gift. It is a gift to the Bashar al-Assad regime. There's no question about that. And of course, he hasn't been above using the Israel issue repeatedly as a distraction. Letting his own Palestinian population approach the Israeli border a few months back, which eventuated in a shooting incident at the border, and so on. So we've seen this before, and I think it's true that this will be a kind of diplomatic gift to him. I'm not sure that it's enough to save the regime or materially alter what's going on within the country. But Prince Turkey may quite be right that if you look at what's going on in Syria in a geostrategic sense and think of it as essentially depriving Iran of its key ally, then from his point of view, it's a pretty compelling argument that this represents a pretty gravely missed opportunity.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Denner, who is in Ramallah on the West Bank of Palestine. He also has an article in the current issue of the New York Review of Books, After September 11th, Our State of Exception. And let's just turn a little bit to that, unless, Mark, you have something to tell me about what's on the ground there to give me a sense of, I take it that the Palestinian people are right behind this. And interesting enough, just finishing up on the subject of the Saudis, it was, after all, the Saudis who proffered a peace proposal a number of years back that the Israelis rejected. Recently, the former head of Mossad, Maya Dagan, castigated the Netanyahu government and reminded them of the folly of turning that proposal down or not even taking it seriously, given the growing isolation of Israel in the region.
Yes. The 2005 proposal, or 2002, I'm sorry, proposal is referred to by Prince Turki Al-Faisal in his article. And, you know, it does, that seems a very long time ago. And you realize, we're still, when you see Israeli diplomats interviewed on television, as I just did earlier today, they're still referring to the Oslo framework. And, you know, we're talking about a peace deal of the early to mid-90s. And in fact, there is a feeling here generally of complete stagnation the Netanyahu government has been completely uninterested in making any progress. We just have a sort of regime solidifying in place based on the wall and a kind of unbearable situation on the ground in the West Bank. It's really shocking to come back here and just see the whole regime of checkpoints and areas A, B, C, and just the sheer difficulty of living here. And this has been, we want, It's an odd thing to come and look at things on the ground, and you realize that when we talk about the situation here, we kind of are pointed or looking up at this kind of cloud of rhetoric in which you hear two-state solution, Oslo, the Saudi plan, all these other things. And meanwhile, things on the ground have simply just gotten steadily worse. And as opposed to the rhetorical talk about the future, the present really is made not of rhetoric but of concrete. You know, it's settlements. It's the wall. It's these permanent facts on the ground that make life here pretty much unbearable. So I think, you know, I have a sense that we're reaching a point, it's not just my sense, where, you could be at the point of another explosion, which have happened periodically in the past, when things have stagnated in the way they have here for the last decade or so. And I'm sad to say that the Obama administration came in with very strongly stated ambitions to move the peace process forward. They suffered an early failure when they tried to force a settlement freeze on the Netanyahu government. The Netanyahu government basically said no. It's a complicated story, but that really is what happened. And they backed down. And that, in a sense, was kind of the end of it. So here we are. And, you know, it's one of those situations where Americans, you know, it's like there's a darkness about policy, and suddenly, boom, like lightning on a darkened landscape, you have an explosion, and it's as if, well, where did this come from? And it's very clear where it's come from, which is in some, not the least sense, lack of urgency on the part of American policy and lack of willingness to take a risk. So here we are again.
Well, Mark Denner, something paradoxical is happening there, surely, and that is in the entire region, you have the Arab Spring, and it is clearly the young Syrians are taking their lives in their hands to try and facing military equipment to bring about their own freedom, and the young Palestinians, I imagine, are no exception, as is the case in Tunisia and Egypt, and indeed in Saudi Arabia, where the royal family are basically trying to buy them off. So I sense a peculiar irony here that you have all these young Israelis protesting about the lack of future in terms of economic opportunity in their country, because it's essentially run by an economic oligarchy. And the same thing is happening on the Arab side. They're saying exactly the same thing. The older, corrupt oligarchs have stolen our future.
Yeah. Yes, you see that. You see that everywhere, of course. It's a little, to me, more complicated and inscrutable here on the West Bank, simply because, you know, I see among young people a kind of great excitement about what has gone on, particularly about what happened in Egypt. But it's unclear when exactly, and that's why I say perhaps it'll happen soon with the declaration of statehood, when it will and how it will manifest itself here in front of us. You're quite right that you have this movement going on at the same time. I'm laughing because it's kind of incredible, this sort of social movement that has to do with cost of living and difficulties of housing and so on in Israel, in which you've had hundreds of thousands of people out demonstrating, predominantly young people. And that movement, you know, ironically, strangely enough, is self-consciously pointed away from the problems of Middle East peace and West Bank and occupied territories and so on, even though, of course, intrinsic, you know, bound up very tightly in the housing problem in Israel has been the occupation of the West Bank and the fact that the government over the last 30-odd years has been putting most of its money into building settlements on the West Bank. I mean, that's been its housing program. And the social movement in Israel is kind of self-consciously looking in the other direction. And I think there's a feeling that if they get to this root of the problem, that will be divisive. You know, it will suddenly be a peace movement rather than a movement about cost of living and housing, which is just, you know, such an astonishing thing. So I'd like to, you know, agree with you. It's on the one hand, you've had this movement sweeping the region, and you expect, well, it's got to emerge here, explode here, and that may well be what happens. I think it's likely to. But there's also a strange temper here of frustration, stagnation, and to some degree disillusionment that makes it a little bit difficult to me, predict what will happen. It's one of the reasons I've been so interested to be here.
Let's take a brief station break now, and I'll be back in a minute talking with Mark Denner from Ramallah.
Now I've been crying lately, thinking about the world as it is. Why must we go on hating? Why can't we live in bliss? 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there I holding out the light on the beach. Well, I should stop pointing fingers, reserve my judgment of all the public action figures, the cowboy presidents, so loud behind the bullhorn, so proud they can't admit when they've made a mistake. While poison spews from a speechwriter's pen, he knows he don't have to say it, so it don't bother him.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Again, I'm speaking with Mark Danner, who is in Ramallah in the Palestinian territory, and we're talking about Palestinian statehood that's all but inevitable soon. He also has an article in the current issue of the New York Review of Books, After September 11th, Our State of Exception. And I still want to get to the article, but it's so interesting to talk to you since you're there on the ground. Do you think, just to finish up on this, do you think that the trigger, though, that could turn the Palestinian youth in terms of the Arab Spring into massive street demonstrations that we've seen elsewhere could be the U.S. veto of Palestinian statehood? Could that be the trigger?
Well, I think it's possible. Although, remember, you know, everybody knows the U.S. is going to veto it. I guess my short answer would be, I don't know. There's a strange reality here where it's almost as if you have a choreographed series of events leading up to the actual vote for statehood, which we assume will be overwhelmingly positive, and the veto in the Security Council, which we also assume is predetermined. I mean, it's hard to believe there's going to be a different result, even though there's a lot of last-minute politicking. So all of that seems to be foreordained.
I was going to say, but doesn't that mean for the Palestinians, you have a vote, the whole world says you are now a state, and however long it takes to veto it, suddenly the whole thing is taken away from them, and the people who take it away from them are the Americans.
Yes. Well, no, you're quite right. That is going to be what happens. I'm just saying, to me it's somewhat difficult to predict what the popular, how extended, put it that way, the popular reaction will actually be. The Israelis, it is widely reported, are going to be cracking down quite severely on the West Bank. And remember, there's an apparatus here that is deeply enmeshed in life all over the West Bank in the form of a very heavily militarized system of checkpoints. And separate roads for Palestinians and Israelis. The Israelis have the capability very easily to shut down all movement on the West Bank, contain things, and so on. So there is, I guess what I'm trying to say is there's more than one player here. And the question is, how will the Israelis react? What will the Palestinians do? What will the Palestinian leadership in the form of the PA, how will they react? How much control will they try to assert over demonstrations? Will they want to contain it, which my expectation is they will. And then there is kind of unpredictable nature of how these things have happened. You know, the first intifada was very much outside of the institutional realm. I mean, the PA wasn't here, and this thing erupted as a kind of popular movement to the surprise of everybody. Will you have something like some equivalent of that happen this time around? There have been sort of popular peace movements, peaceful resistance, in various villages that have cropped up in reaction originally to the building of the wall. What part will they play? So I think there are a lot of kind of imponderables here. And again, it's one of the reasons I wanted to be here.
So, Mark Danner, of course, You've written one of the most important books about the post 9/11 issue of torture, Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. And you've written this article in the current issue of the New York Review of Books, After September 11th, Our State of Exception. And I think probably people have seen quite enough of the 9/11 coverage, which has been understandably pretty intense. But it's had a kind of a jingoistic and patriotic flavor. It certainly hasn't had a flavor of reflection of where we've come 10 years later. And interestingly enough, Paul Krugman wrote a piece on Sunday, a blog piece that's infuriated the right wing in this country, basically saying that what happened after 9/11 was deeply shameful. And he goes after people like Rudy Giuliani and President Bush as fake heroes, and feels an atrocity has been hijacked for political purposes, and not just for political purposes, but for political purposes that have ended up being incredibly counterproductive and devastating for the United States, not to mention the 5,000 lives that the U.S. has lost since the 3,000 that were killed on 9/11, but the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis and Afghanis who've lost their lives too. It is pretty astounding that this moment has gone by without that kind of serious reflection.
Yeah, I suppose it's astounding, but is it surprising? I'm not sure it is. I mean, the very point that Paul Krugman made has ensured that the remembrance of 9/11 has the same qualities the immediate aftermath of the events did. That is, it becomes a kind of sacred, patriotic exercise. I know the feeling ran very high in New York around the time of the anniversary and during the anniversary, but I completely agree with you and with Krugman that some of the reflections one might have wanted to hear about the stranger things that happened during the last decade and the more harmful things, not least a completely unnecessary war that was fought in Iraq that killed, as you said, hundreds of thousands of people, including more than 4,000 Americans, and some of the other severe mistakes that were made that really you have seen almost no debate, discussion, calm remembrance of why these mistakes were made. Instead, it's become a kind of exercise in national patriotic worship. And I think that's an enormous pity, particularly since I think it's fair to say that some of the aftermath of 9/11, particularly the events surrounding the Iraq War, were times in which many of our most resilient national institutions were really undermined in a way that they haven't really recovered from. I'm thinking about not only the government, and not just the Bush administration, but the Congress, which, of course, supported the war, but also the journalistic establishment, the intellectual elite, which largely supported the war. We had in the wake of that war, a couple of years later, very extensive apologies published in the pages of our nation's two most influential newspapers, the New York Times and the Washington Post, both of which confessed to terrible ongoing mistakes in reporting and having essentially failed the country when it came to looking at the causes that were put forward by the administration for going to war. We've had no, so far as I can see, no reflection back on those mistakes. It's just kind of been passed over. And when you look at, in general, and the piece is really about this, some of the egregious decisions that were made, in particular, the decision to torture, we're talking about a kind of moral ambiguity and a moral burden and a moral stain that the country still bears, not only because those decisions were made, not only because we have an extensive record of torture that was used and who decided and how, but we're still in a world in which the former president, George W. Bush, and Vice President Richard Cheney can publish their memoirs and basically proudly say within them, yeah, I decided to torture and I'd do it again. George W. Bush recounts how when his CIA director, George Tenet, asked him whether he should waterboard Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, his proud answer was, damn right. And, of course, Richard Cheney has been on a lot of television interviews leading up to 9/11, talking about how he wouldn't do anything differently and how he would use these techniques again and excoriating the Obama administration for not using them. And finally, and I think most shockingly and most sadly, is the Obama administration, which, on the one hand, the president has said, and so far as we know, there's truth to it, that he's forbidden these techniques. But even in saying this, and saying I've prohibited torture, as he said when accepting the Nobel Peace Prize, that statement itself embodies some of the moral ambiguity and moral torture, as it were, the country finds itself in now. Because, you know, President Obama does not have the power to prohibit torture. Torture is illegal according to domestic statute, according to international treaty. It is absolutely illegal. And when he says I prohibited it, you know, by virtue of his order as president, it really, in a sense, is a refers back to his predecessor who claimed the power to order it. You can't order it. You can't prohibit it. It's illegal. So we now have, I mean, this is what the phrase state of exception means in the title of my New York Review piece, that we've entered this world, this kind of state of emergency that is endless, where we've become, in a sense, a different people. We forget about it. We don't think about it. But in fact, torture, which was once illegal, which was once an anathema, is now, in effect, a policy choice. And that is an enormous change. And there was no, of course, reflection on that or talk about it. There's no national conversation about it. We seem to have accepted it. And it means that the way other countries look at us, including countries in the Middle East, is profoundly changed. I mean, the U.S. still thinks of itself as a leader in human rights, but the rest of the world does not. And Americans seem strangely unaware of this.
Well,
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I just interviewed recently Glenn Carl, the CIA officer who was involved in torture.
Yes.
I mean, he's obviously a decent man who was put in an impossible situation. It felt that, you know, he knew the orders were coming from Cheney. He thought they were wrong morally and practically because they thought he knew they had the wrong guy. And it's just amazing to think that those stories aren't coming to the fore. I guess Ali Soufran's new book that the CIA is censoring may have an impact because he's detailed a litany of missed opportunities and high-level dysfunction between the CIA and the FBI. And as you know, Mark, you know, a lot of this void of information about what really went wrong has been filled by these nonsensical 9/11 truthers. So there's so much work to be done to get the truth out because, you know, not just the damage that's done, but clearly the full story hasn't been told.
Well, I think that's true, and I'm very glad that Ali Soufran's book is coming out. I haven't read it yet. I think it was published today, if I'm not mistaken. But I have followed, first of all, the writing he's done under his own name. And earlier, he, of course, was widely quoted by a lot of journalists without using his name. As the man who was the first interrogator to work interrogating Abu Zubaydah, who was the first major high-level detainee to be tortured in the spring of 2002. So Ali Soufran is a very credible figure with a long record of speaking out candidly about what was actually going on in the intelligence world, and in particular with respect to interrogation and so-called enhanced interrogation techniques. And he's been absolutely relentless in arguing, as an experienced interrogator, that these things don't work, that they're counterproductive. And he, when he argues that, he does it with a great deal of credibility. I don't know that there's anybody in the government who's had more experience than he has in interrogating terrorists. Not to put too fine a point on it, he knows he's got an enormous amount of credibility when he writes that. When he writes that book, so I hope his book gets a lot of attention and a lot of people read it. having said that, I'm not sure, and I say this sadly, that on the one hand, there is more to come out. I'm glad his book is being published, and I hope many more will be as well. But, and again, I say this with sadness, that I think the main story about torture, about many of the mistakes leading up to 9/11 and after it, a lot of those stories are out. And, you know, when it comes to torture in particular, we know a great deal about what happened in those so-called black sites. We know a great deal about what happened in Guantanamo. And I would like to think that the real problem here is that the truth has to come out. Once it does, you know, the attitude of the American people will change. We'll be focusing more on this and so on. But I've been writing about this. You know, I published the first book I did on torture in 2004. That's 7 years ago. And at this point, I don't know. I hate to say it, but I think that it isn't simply a question of the truth not having come out. It's a question of the fact that many Americans, for what other reason we can speculate about, are willing to live with this. I have to say I was surprised about it, that there was outrage following the images from Abu Ghraib. But in many other cases, you know, when it came to waterboarding and other things, in essence, Americans seem willing to live with it. I hate to come to that conclusion, but I think it's hard to avoid.
Just in closing, though, Mark Danner, I'm arguing that the truth has not come out in the sense that nobody has done a full accounting of the mistakes that Bush and Cheney and the administration plus the intelligence community made in allowing this to happen, this 9/11 attack. The monstrous incompetence, and this is some of the stuff that's coming out in Souffron's book about how the missed opportunities to detect this, the attitude of Bush and Cheney towards Clinton, the dismissive way that Condoleezza Rice, et cetera, were towards Richard Clarke and the other Cassandras who were warning this was coming, along with the TEDs, the CIA, the extent to which obviously some kind of an agreement was made between Bush and Tenet that nobody would be held responsible and everything would be fine, and they just turned this opportunity into one for launching wars, putting through his own reactionary domestic agenda for which he wasn't elected, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is what I feel is missing is, you know, the thing that haunts Cheney and Bush, I think, what really haunts them, and this is why the 9/11 truth is so stupid, is what really haunts these people is that they are responsible and they've never accepted responsibility and that they did screw up. Not just once, but many times.
Yes, I certainly. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's my final rant.
Well, I agree with your final rant, and I think that's true. And I think there's a lot of sort of psycho-political thinking to be done on why exactly they did the things they did. And I agree with you that in essence, some of it had to do simply with guilt and with the realization that they had been warned about this. That some of those warnings were explicit in the form of the presidential daily brief. About, you know, bin Laden determined to attack within the United States and so on, and quite a number of other things as well. I mean, if you look at the Colleen Rowley thing from Minneapolis, if you look at the reports from Arizona about pilots and training, if you look at the failure to follow the two 9/11 terrorist conspirators in San Diego, tracked by the CIA from Malaysia, and then inexplicably never passed on to the FBI. There's a whole story there that I gather Ali Soufan has a number of things to say about. It was implied in Larry Wright's wonderful book, The Looming Tower, that the idea that this, you know, was a question of the government not connecting the dots, it was simple bureaucratic incompetence and so on, is ridiculous, and that it seems much more likely that the Saudis were trying to recruit these guys. There's a lot of evidence for that. And so the CIA essentially held off specifically telling the FBI. And, you know, in retrospect, that was a horrible, horrible mistake because, in effect, they could have prevented probably the plot from coming to fruition. And that is something that we have not talked about. And that, you know, to go back to your rant, Bush and Cheney surely knew. I think I agree that there's a lot of spade work to be done here. In joining those stories together. And I think that the realization of the failure to prevent those attacks had a lot to do with what happened subsequent to them. I mean, you know, the simple reality is that you didn't need a lot of new laws and a lot of new government powers to prevent those attacks. You just needed to do the things that the various agencies, particularly the CIA and the FBI, were supposed to do. And one of the functions in the wake of 9/11 of the Patriot Act, of you know, all of these increased powers for the CIA, the increased surveillance, the warrantless wiretapping, you know, you can go on and on. One of the reasons for all of those things, it seems to me, is insofar as you say we have to take the gloves off, to use the phrase of the era, you're implying that the reason for the attack's success was that the gloves were on in some way. In other words, there weren't sufficient government powers to allow you to prevent the attacks to begin with. Therefore, in the wake of their success, you ask for all these sufficient powers, which themselves are essentially exculpatory. So I think you're completely right. I think a lot of what happened after 9/11 has to do with the failure to do certain things before 9/11. And to the extent that Ali Soufan's book is about that story, I salute him. I hope a lot of people read it. I hope it's a bestseller. And maybe it will begin, maybe after the anniversary now, we're ready to have the kind of debate that you and I are lamenting to take place on the 10th anniversary.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today from Ramallah in the Palestinian territory, Mark Danner. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Ian. It's great to talk to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Danner, who is a writer, journalist, and professor. He's a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker, a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books, where he has an article out now, After September 11, Our State of Exception. He also wrote a number of bestsellers, including Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and The War on Terror. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about whether there are such things as jobs in the future.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more.